The Western movie has become an American tradition. Films like Stagecoach, Red River, Shane, High Noon, and The Magnificent Seven will never be forgotten. Now, Dino De Laurentiis presents perhaps the greatest Western of them all, The Shootist, the story of John Bernard Brooks, the last of the great gunfighters, a living legend. The role is being played by an actor who is himself a living legend, John Wayne.
I won't be wronged, I won't be insulted, I won't be laid a hand on. I don't do these things to other people. I require the same from them.
You hold it right there. Just throw me your wallet.
Yes, sir. A little something extra.
Co-starring with Wayne is a group of Hollywood's finest actors. James Stewart.
You have a cancer. Advanced.
How much time do I have?
2 months, 6 weeks. There's no way to tell.
Lauren Bacall.
Mr. Brooks, you are a notorious individual, utterly lacking in character or decency. You're an assassin.
It's according to which end of the gun you're on.
Rubbish.
Ron Howard.
Would you give me a shooting lesson?
Well, a man should know how to handle a gun.
How could you get into so many fights and then always come out on top?
I found out early that most men, regardless of cause or need, blink an eye or draw a breath before they pull a trigger. I won't.
Richard Boone.
Well, I heard that you were in town for a very short time.
That's true.
John Carradine.
I'm Hezekiah Beckham, the Undertaker, sir.
Oh, Beckham, you're going to do to me what they did to John Wesley Harden. You're going to lay me out, let the public come by and gawp at me for 50 cents a head.
Mr. Brooks, you're a hard man.
I'm alive.
Scatman Crothers.
Mr. Brooks, it's pure pleasure to groom your horse, and even a greater pleasure to do business with you.
Harry Morgan.
Brooks, this is 1901. The old days are gone, and you don't know it. You've plain plum outlived your time.
Richard Lenz.
You must appreciate, sir, that you are the most celebrated shootist extant.
Extant?
Still existing.
Sherry North.
Everybody knows who you are. I'd be Mrs. J.B. Brooks. I'd be somebody.
Hugh O'Brien.
Old Brooks is cashing in.
That's hard news. It's a man I could have taken.
This film has the makings of a classic.
I would not die a death like I just described. Not if I had your courage.
In it, John Wayne gives the most remarkable performance of his career.
I'm a dying man, scared of the dark.
As he recreates the final days...
There's more to being a man than handling a gun.
...of the man they called the Shootist.
This spoiler-filled podcast is recorded live, unscripted, and intended for those over 18. Now prepare your ears for the audio stimulation they've been waiting for all day as we step into
the spoiler room.
Good old-fashioned American values of a man with a gun doling out his own justice, yes.
Yes, yes, what this country was founded on.
What is... Fashion. Yes, exactly. And welcome to another edition of the Spoiler Room. It's a small crew with me today. This is our last Big 4-0 special, and we decided to do something. I don't think I've ever done a Western on the Spoiler Room till tonight. And so tonight,
you find out why.
And I'm trying to think of why. In the Spoiler Room tonight with me is, you heard his voice, Scotty D. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Mark, it's great to be here. It's so great to be part of such a huge and welcoming and just a varied crew of people tonight. I mean, talking Westerns, man, it just draws them out. They just want to come in there.
It's such a popular genre nowadays.
I know. I see. You know, when I did an episode of Movieocrity on the movie Django, and I just knew from the beginning, I'm like, yep, this is just going to attract them all. And boy, I was right. When I saw it go up to like 10, 20, 30 views, I was just like, yep, that was time well spent, boy.
But I know you enjoy Westerns. I really enjoy Westerns, and just found out recently my eldest son enjoys Westerns. So that was kind of a cool surprise. And it is a genre that I think has faded over the years. But this one came out 40 years ago. And it has a number of significant things, but most importantly, it was John Wayne's last one, and it was The Shootist. And the story, according to IMDb, is a dying gunfighter spends his last days looking for a way to die with a minimum amount of pain and maximum amount of dignity. And that is right. But, you know, I think there's more going on in The Shootist than just that story. Now, this was based off of a novel, right, Scott?
Yeah. It was based on a novel by a guy. I'm going to mispronounce his name. Glennon Swarthout.
Okay.
And he actually wrote, and I think he helped write the screenplay. It was a very popular book and everything. And I think they were trying to get it made for years. And this is finally the culmination. And it's a perfect movie to end John Wayne's career on. So
it is. It's it's been a long time since I watched this movie. And then while watching it, I'm watching the credits roll and I'm like, holy crap, they're in it. And they're in it. And they're, I mean, because you got Jimmy Stewart, Lauren Bacall, you know, a little bit older Ron Howard, but you got Richard Boone. You got Harry Morgan, John Carradine, Scatman Crothers. I mean, this is like, folks, this is like a who's who of folks who had been in westerns or similar to popular. And this was like, you know, it was a really good swan song, if you will, for John Wayne. And I would dare say this is kind of a meta film of sorts, wouldn't you, Scott? You know, John Wayne kind of giving the last ride.
It is. It was not intended to be that. He was completely intending to go on and do a couple more movies, but he was just too ill, and he unfortunately passed away 3 years later. But it is. I mean, as much as, say, I guess it was, what was it, maybe like 17 years later that Clint Eastwood did Unforgiven, something like that, 16, 17 years later, something around there. And Unforgiven was kind of seen as like the him like kind of like putting the coda on his Western career. This is definitely that for John Wayne when he did The Shootist in 1976.
Yeah, because I mean the film opens with clips from John Wayne's previous films, and he's playing J.B. Books, who is a legendary shootist who's killed many men, and I thought they cut that those scenes very well. And you got Ronnie Howard's voice, his very recognizable voice overing it, and I'm like, wow, I'm like, it is just eerie how much of, you know, bittersweet this movie is watching it, seeing so many people, especially John Wayne, in basically, you know, also being meta though, even for 1976, in referencing the kind of fading of not only the Western, but of some of these people's careers.
It was just uncannily just very appropriate. It wasn't trying to be as apropos as it was, it seemed to unknowingly comment on itself. Mm-hmm. It was unintentionally meta. Yes, absolutely. And you got, as you said, you have that cast of supporting characters, so that the film almost seems like a reunion of sorts of all these old friends gathering, you know, to like send off, you know, the legend, basically.
Yeah, it really has that feeling. And just because of the way the situation played out later, you're right. I think that's what makes it even more interesting, is how the fact that it wasn't intended to be like that, but it's one of those things where you just watch it, it is just eerie how significant the film becomes after, you know, events later on. And now it's directed by Don Siegel, who I forgot directed this. He directed Dirty Harry, as well as a couple Westerns too, right, Scott?
Oh, yeah. This is their first time. They'd wanted to work together for a while. Mm-hmm. And it surprised a lot of people that John Wayne was actually kind of a fan of Dirty Harry, to the extent that he actually wound up doing a film very much like Dirty Harry a little later, a couple years after, in the 70s, McHugh.
Right.
But they'd wanted to work together for a while. But, yeah, he had worked a lot with Clint Eastwood. doing films like Two Meals for Sister Sarah, Coogan's Bluff, The Beguiled, which was a film that did, like, I think it didn't do much business when it was out, but now it's kind of regarded almost as a classic. And, you know, of course, later on, continue to work with Eastwood with Escaped Alcatraz and other things like that. But, yeah, he was known for that from a ways back. And, of course, you know, he goes back ages and ages and ages. Way back to the 50s, you got films like Riot and Cell Block 11. You've got, well, God, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Which, yeah, I understand that's a long way from a Western. But this guy was a guy who had an amazing career. The Killers, just really great stuff.
Yeah, and well, you know, with his filmography and that, this was one of his last films. I mean, he did four more after this, but still, it was, you know, getting near the end of his career, kind of. And the whole film, and we'll get into some specifics and with some of the characters, but just the film as a whole, you just get this feeling like they're just putting everything they want to into this film, because a lot of these people are bookending big chapter in their life, almost. I mean, yeah, you know, the stars that are in this. And we've mentioned John Wayne, who is, I think, is just brilliant as Books. And the way he plays this character, he feels like the old, you know, characters, the older version of the characters he played when he was younger in the Westerns. Mm-hmm. You know, it didn't he? He felt like that old seasoned veteran.
Shooters. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. He's you know, I'm gonna be very honest with you.
Go ahead.
Tell you that this is a difficult podcast for me. And the reason is that the funny thing is that I am, like, you meet me, I am the most, he would hate me. I am the most, I am the most liberal person, you know.
Sure.
I'm, like, you know, very outspoken in that regard and everything like that. At the same time, I have such a fascination and tremendous respect for John Wayne. I really do. And it's very hard. He's one of those people where it's very hard for me to talk about him without becoming emotional. Mm-hmm. That's how much I really love this actor. I had all the books. I tried to study as many of his movies and his performances as I could. And I always found that he brought something really special to the roles that he did. It's true that this guy, people talk about range when they talk about actors, you know, and they talk about, and when they talk about range, they usually are referring to something that is on the surface. Okay, Meryl Streep is an amazing actress, but with a lot of range. But what is amazing about her isn't the fact that she can, like, adopt another accent like that, you know. Mm-hmm. What's amazing is what's underneath the surface. John Wayne was never somebody who was going to adopt a lot of different accents or mannerisms when he goes from part to part.
Yeah.
But if you look at each and every performance he gives, there is something deeper there, especially when the script is strong. And there is something amazing that he brings to every part. And whereas he kind of has this image as being iconic, and rightly so, it didn't come from him always portraying himself as someone who was invincible. In fact, he often brought a lot of hidden human frailty, something that he would never want to admit, or his characters would never want to admit, but he always brought that. The Searchers, which is probably my favorite movie of his, definitely. Sands of Iwo Jima, there is a sequence in that movie where I was just mentioning this to a friend of mine earlier in the week, where there's a scene where he has to keep the sergeant or whatever, and he has to keep his men from rushing to save their comrades who are dying on the battlefield because it's a trap and they're going to get shot down.
Right.
And the camera just kind of goes into a close-up of his face as he has to listen to all of his men dying and begging for help that will never come. When you look at his face in this scene, you just can see it, you know. And then you have other parts like The Quiet Man, and all that kind of culminates into this part here that he plays in The Shootist. Yes, he was this young person that you see in all the clips. If you notice, all the clips were for films that he did like in the 40s and 50s.
Right.
The really early films that he had done, like black and white. And he was spry and he was thinking, now, oh no, he has to use a pillow to sit down to relieve his old bones. He still has more gumption and more, you know, fortitude than most people, but he's clearly winding down. And you get that. And he's absolutely resentful of it and having a hard time with it. There's a line he gives in this movie, Mark. I know I'm rambling. No. But there's a line he gives in this movie. Mm-hmm. It is the most, oh my God, it's devastating. And it's devastating, especially when you take everything, when you take this figure and what he's meant to represent. And he's at this table speaking with the Lauren Bacall character, Bond Rogers there, Bond. Mm-hmm. And there's like, you're this, you know, unforgiving killer and stuff like that. And he just looks at her and he says, point blank, I'm a dying man scared of the dark.
Yeah.
Holy cow. I mean, that line, it'll just pierce your heart when he gives it, because he gives it with such brutality and such honesty. And he doesn't give it like as a weapon. He just says it matter-of-factly. And he has these subtleties from performance to performance. And anybody who would just chalk him up as being a walking cliche is doing more than selling him short, they're selling themselves short, because they're really missing out on an amazing body of work.
He brings a lot to this role in The Shootist, especially. It is a culmination. You can feel, you know, as we said, it wasn't really intended to be meta because he had planned to move on. But at the same time, it gives you a wonder if maybe he was kind of questioning it, because his performance in this is just so strong and so honest and so, you know, it's solid. Like you said, range. We get a man who has resolved himself to this once he gets the second opinion on the fact that he's dying, which I tell you, for me watching this again, that's a bittersweet scene when he and Jimmy Stewart first see each other, and we get the first scene where Jimmy Stewart's playing the doctor, and the way those two are acting, it's like people, I think, don't realize that's like two powerhouses from back in their day in the same scene, and they make so much of that scene. I mean, Stewart is just, he was fantastic in this as well. I loved his Doc Hostetler.
Mm-hmm. And he apparently, according to what I had read on like internet sources, which, of course, let's just say right now, are not very reliable.
No.
He didn't feel very good about that. He had Jimmy Stewart had mostly retired
right
from films. And his hearing was very poor, so he didn't hear the line readings, and he was feeling very self-conscious about his delivery and everything like that. But when it came through honestly, because you got what it was two old friends.
Yeah,
you know. And of course, you know, and if anybody has seen, like, I mean, Jimmy Stewart and John Wayne co-starred in one of my favorite John Wayne movies, and it's a film which John Wayne, even though he's often top billed, he's practically a supporting character in the movie.
Oh, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance?
Man Who Shot Liberty Valance is one of the most amazing films.
It is.
Oh, man. And to see those two together again, and you got that camaraderie, you know, that really meant something. Yeah. I mean, Jimmy Stewart would continue to show up in occasional movies. Like, I think there was a couple Robert Mitchum did a couple later on, late in the game, Philip Marlowe films. I think Jimmy Stewart was in Airport 77 or something. But this is the last really great performance he gave. You know,
yeah, he gives it its all, and seeing those two in that scene is fantastic. I mean, it's just, you look at this going, here we have two really classic actors, and you get this feeling of they're realizing they're doing one of the last scenes probably they'll be doing, you know, in a major picture. And yeah, it's just, I loved his character and seeing him and old Ronnie Howard in here, the young guy who holds his own pretty well. I like the scenes with him and Wayne. John Wayne didn't seem to, you know, try to steal the scene too much. I felt there was a respect between them, and I really liked the difference between the Gillum Rogers character, which Ron played, which is this young kid who kind of idolizes books for the romance of being a shootist, if you will, a shooter, and then books being the realist of how things really are. I love their scenes together. What'd you think about those two, how they played off each other?
They were great. And like you said, yes, he showed a lot of respect. He did that most of his career, John Wayne did. Mm-hmm. Occasionally he'd get other actors who were a little kind of barging, who wanted to kind of assert themselves and kind of boost themselves up. Thinking of Kirk Douglas, certainly.
Sure.
You know, who again was a great actor in his own right. I'm not trashing Kirk Douglas, but apparently there was some animosity at some point. I don't know why, but yeah, I think that he certainly kind of ushered him in. And apparently, one of the parts that John Wayne wanted to do after this involved Ron Howard. He seemed, which signals that he was impressed enough. Ron Howard, he's grown into such a good director.
Yeah. You
know, he is, you know, no matter how many Grinches he does, he's a great director. He is a really good director. If you look at his body work, he's a good director. And so he often doesn't get really a lot of props for his acting because he was an actor mainly from TV, Andy Griffith, and then Happy Days. And even American Graffiti could be seen as just an extension of Happy Days in some extent. But he's really good in this movie, and he really plays the part well. You can, and a lot of his best moments are his reactions.
Right.
In the movie, when you see his reactions to, oh, he's so happy that he's got this hero that he's idolized up there, and he sees that, oh gosh, and every time he is humbled whenever he gets too close. He's humbled when he finds out that this man that he idolizes is about to die. He's humbled when he finally sees death. He's humbled when he gets the shooting lesson.
Yeah.
And you see that. And you know, you see it in that wounded expressions that he gives. But it's never just a simple like of being chastised. It's something much more involved. It's about childhood pride and being kind of beaten back by the reality of the world.
Yeah.
And it's really great. And I will say that I'm not going to mention it now because I'm sure you're going to get to it later. But it is, you know, it's also part of one of my absolute favorite moments ever put on film.
Yeah, we'll talk about the ending.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Yeah.
We definitely want to talk about the ending because, yeah, as the description said, it is a man who tries to go out with a lot of dignity, and we'll talk a little bit about how the J.B. Books character, how he decides to go out. But I just want to mention briefly some of the other characters. Lauren Bacall, who apparently did not like Wayne because he spit a lot. According to some trivia, which I can totally see. But Lauren Bacall, seeing her on screen again, she did, I thought, really well in this as the caretaker of the bed and breakfast, basically the lodging where J.B. Books is staying. And I loved their banter back and forth, and I always thought her name was interesting. Bond was an interesting name for a female character. You know, it's not a common name.
Wasn't it based on Ward Bond? I'd read think so. Somewhere that it was based on like on Ward Bond, of course, who being another iconic Western star, you know?
Yeah, I think so too. And though, you know, who surprised me and I forgot he was in here as well, though, was Harry Morgan. Harry Morgan playing the Marshal Thibodeau. I loved how his character handled finding out this shootist guy was in his town, because he is just an ass.
Oh, he's terrible, but he's such a character about being terrible.
I know.
And you totally get the feeling that the only reason Wayne doesn't shoot him out of his socks is because he is a lawman, and damn it, I just won't do it, you know? Well,
and I think there's a little bit of amusement with him, too, because there is that scene, though, where they kind of have a little bit of a reminder of who he actually is right in the beginning in the kitchen there, where Marshall Thibodeau is going off on, oh, I can't wait to, you know, till you die, and the thing thing I'm going to do to your grave. Oh. How do you say that? Oh, I
says, when you die, says when you die, what I'm gonna do to your grave won't pass for flowers.
That's a great line. And, you know, you get that moment between them, though, where he just, the Books just goes for his gun just ever so casually, and suddenly Thibodeau straightens up and he's no longer joking, and he actually looks scared.
Yeah, don't you forget who you're dealing with.
Yeah, you know, it's like, yeah, I'll let you go so far, but just remember, I could shoot you, you know, in a half second. You know, it's like,
well, I mean, I think it also so much of this, you know, a lot of what the characters went, it's hard to put this, pin this down to one character, because so mm-hmm. much in this character is an echo of the different characters Wayne had played over the decades.
Yeah.
But so much of this character is about the standards mm-hmm. and human dignity. You know, you don't get to, it's about being polite.
Yep.
It's about knowing what's right and wrong. It's about affording people respect when and only when they have earned it. And he's crossed that line. You know, he crosses that line. And it's like, you know, you don't get to do that. You don't get to barge in here and dance on my grave before I'm even buried. You need to show me, I've been around longer than you. I have seen things that you've never seen. You owe me at least some basic human decency.
Right.
And he doesn't, and Harry Morgan doesn't, the character Thibodeau does not give him that. And he will never give him that, because Thibodeau is not a character who is ever redeemed in the movie. He's a pig-headed, like, character. And he will go in for all the stupid flash and razzle-dazzle that J.B. Books never will. When he finds out that there's that someone wants to write a series of articles, oh, make sure they spell my name right, you know?
Yeah, you know, where Books is like, don't you write a damn thing in your paper, or I'll come and shoot you, you know?
Yeah. It's like, or he shoves the gun in his mouth and says, make like that's a nipple.
Yeah. He puts a gun in his mouth, make like that's a nipple, and then he makes him bend over and kicks him in the ass. It's such a great scene with the reporter. And the reporter shows up later, as Scott mentioned. He tries to get a story because he's going for the juicy story because Books is such a legend. And I thought that was kind of an interesting little statement, too, on popularity, you know, because later on, Books has an old flame show up who he thinks at first is, oh, she's come to see me in that. And then all of a sudden she's like, well, you're going to die soon, right?
Well, that scene, you know, that is an amazing. And here's the thing is that I've seen this. This is, I don't know, probably my fifth or sixth time seeing it. True. But I don't think I've watched this movie in like the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so this was a very nice reminder of how good it was. And I had, for some reason, forgotten about that scene until it started. I'm like, oh boy, I forgot about this. And this scene, this old flame,
Sarepta.
Yeah, and
I love these names.
Yeah, Sarepta, played by Sheree North, who, you know, let's face it, she's obviously was not one of the prim and proper ladies from Brooks's life.
No, no, she was a lady of ill repute.
Yeah, I mean I don't know if they I don't think they explicitly say that she was a prostitute or anything, but they certainly say that she was somebody who went from partner to partner,
implied. I think it was implied.
Yeah, and but still, he had a lot of love and respect for her. But she comes to him, and it would be easy to throw her under the bus or under the horse and carriage, as it were. But she's desperate.
Yeah.
She spent every last penny she had to come out and see him. I don't know what she expected if she knew the man. You know, I don't know what she expected if he would say, well, sure, go ahead and, drag my name through the mud. Because there's no subtlety there. There's no sense of honor. And that's what he tried to bring to, and that's what he stood for. He stood for honor. Because he said, she even said what the reporter doesn't know he'll make up. Which is what happened to all of those, heroes of the old West. You know, if you read all those old stories back then, almost none of it was true. She was desperate, though. She was, because she was living probably in abject poverty.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you don't have anything else, you still have your humanity and you still have your dignity and you still have your honor. And those sound like really quaint things when you're starving. And when you're doing God knows what to get by, as we can kind of imagine she was, you know. But still, it means something. Something. It's important. And he has this moment of betrayal where when they first see each other, it's so sweet.
Well, he's happy. He thinks, here's a dying man, and he gets to see a woman who he truly cared about, and he's talking about, I should have probably got hitched to you. So for him, that was the most, you're like, oh wow, he must really, you know, cared for her. And she's like, well, yeah, let's do it now. It's just a piece of paper. And he's like, wait, what?
Yeah, he brings it up.
Yeah,
you know? He brings it up. She doesn't even have to bring it up. I mean, he says, you know. And, you know, in your final days, I imagine you're thinking about, you know, what might have been. You know, I'm not leaving any children behind. What's going to be my legacy? Just a bunch of dead bodies, you know? And they have this scene where they really start talking about how much they loved each other. And, you know, did you ever get married? No. Did you ever get – no, we really should have, you know. I should have done it, you know. You were so special to me. And then when her motives become clear.
Yeah.
I mean, she's not even that creepy about it. She doesn't realize how bad she's getting. But as she's talking, it just gets worse and worse. And he's just suddenly realizes that, oh, man, she's now just somebody who's trying to take advantage of the book's legacy.
And that's where you get kind of that range you were talking about before with him, because he gets this change of look on his face from like actual sincerity, like, oh, this is great that she's here. And he just gets this look like, ah, you fucking leech.
well, I mean, it's even more than, it's such a betrayal, you know, because it's not even a, it's not like a betrayal of like something somebody did. It's a betrayal of the heart. Mm-hmm. And when you find out that there's someone you cared about, I mean, how many people out there who are listening to this now, and hopefully there's more of you listening than there are on this show. how many of you listening have had that moment where someone you loved and someone you cared about, not from something they did, but just a complete change in attitude. And they showed such a complete change in personality when you came across them later on. And it tarnished this thing in your heart that was really pure, that was really special. That's what this scene is.
Yeah.
In this movie, you know?
And it's interesting. And watching this, the way Siegel directs this, every, you know, kind of veteran actor or, you know, even actors, they kind of each get their set piece or scene with John Wayne throughout this film. I mean, you get this one here, you know, Lauren Bacall shows up a number of times throughout, but you get the Jimmy Stewart scenes, which I will say it's really heartbreaking when they get this scene because John Wayne's character Books is there. He comes into Carson City and he's there for the last, basically we see the last week of his life. And in that scene though, where Stewart is describing to Books what's going to happen with the cancer, that is such a but everybody gets a scene. She gets a scene, and then even Scatman Crothers, he and Wayne have a fantastic scene about haggling over the horse. I mean, I love Scatman Crothers to begin with, but that scene,
he's one of my favorite character actors. I love him. He's great.
He is. And I love that scene, but you get, you know, that set piece kind of too. And, you know, Wayne gets it with Harry Martin. It felt like certain one, you know, it's felt almost, just,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's almost like this guy's, you know, he knows he's going to die and he's kind of just going down the line of people he may have known or it's kind of everybody saying kind of goodbye.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, it's almost like people are coming by to say their last respects. Now the scenes aren't that. The scenes are always something else, whether it's about the horse or it's about, you know, this. It's often about what they can get out of them. But everybody's still trying to get. But so it's not supposed to be about that, but it often takes on the air of people coming by to say goodbye, whether they realize it or not. And again, it was not intended that they were saying goodbye to John Wayne. It was intended that they were just saying goodbye to this character. But the movie became that.
Right.
You know, there's a scene of yeah, Scatman Crothers is amazing. And, you know, he would continue to be in movies for a few more years and would be great, you know. And, you know, The Shining. He'd even wind up being in sort of another great pseudo-Western, Bronco Billy. Let's say it's not a great movie, but it's a good movie. And it's definitely – but it is a great role for Scatman Crothers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but you get even like this part where we, you know, we talk about the people who are getting something from the cameo by John Carradine. Now, John Carradine, I will be honest with you, is an actor. I view he, in my view, and people are completely welcome to completely disagree with me and come up and say, no, he was so much more. He was a working man's actor.
Yeah.
Yes, he gave good performances, but more often than not, he took the job. Whatever it was, he took the job. And I think that he has a huge filmography, and it kind of is a testament to that. He just knew, like, okay, this is what we're supposed to do here. I'll show up to work on time. This is what we're going to do. And that's mainly what he did. This part was really something. First of all, he's cast as an undertaker, and if you need somebody to look like the Paler of Death, John Carradine's your man. You know, what is it that they said on Mystery Science Theater 3000? Has he always been 200 years old?
Beckham the Undertaker, who also is trying to get something out of the book character.
Yeah, and it doesn't seem like that at first, but. You know, again, he knows, like, you're going to turn me into John Wesley Harding. You're going to prop me up in a coffin full of embalming or whatever. And, you know, turn me into a tourist attraction. And that's it. Even that is an amazing part. And I think it's one of Carradine's better roles, too.
It is. Yeah. He makes the most of it. And what I love about that is how Books gets $50 out of the caretaker.
I still can't figure out how he's owed $50, but he, you know, there's no question about it in the scene.
The way he puts it, the way that conversation goes, you're like, I'd give him the $50.
Yes, sir.
John Wayne, but he's gonna kick your ass if you don't give him the $50. It's like, Yeah, I love that scene. But yeah, you get those scenes like that. And then we get into the meat of the story, because like I said, each day we kind of get these kind of set pieces and scenes. But as it goes along, we get to meet a couple folks who are up and comers who either have a grudge against him or want to prove themselves against the shootist. And we get one of, I think, two gunfights in this actual film. One in the beginning where he's sleeping with his gun and the two guys show up. And when this happened, I forgot how violent this film actually was. I'm like, well, it is 76, but that shootout scene gets a bit bloody, doesn't it, Scott?
Yeah, no, PG was very accurate back then. PG was never meant to mean the film that you can just send your kids off to without a thought of what was in it. PG meant parental guidance. And some of the movies that John Wayne made, even into the 70s, were rated G, and some weren't. And this one definitely was not. It's not as bloody as a Clint Eastwood spaghetti western, but it is certainly bloody in the sequences. And I think part of that comes from Don Siegel.
Mm-hmm.
Don Siegel doesn't really shy away from showing the brutality of violence. He often never has. Even in a lighthearted film like Two Mules for Sister Sarah, there was always like some bit of savagery going on. And then you have films like Hell is for Heroes and everything like that, you know, where, you know, it's much more explicit. And of course, Dirty Harry, which, you know, raised the bar for film violence, basically. I don't know if that was a badge of honor for anybody, but I mean, it certainly did. And you see when someone gets shot, you see them go down, but you see them go down with such a sudden and rapid savagery that it is, it's like the film tries to retain the romanticism of the ideals that J.B. Books holds, but it tries to strip away the romanticism of the violence, you know, as like, for instance, the Ron Howard character, Gillum, has a romanticism about the violence. It tries to strip that away whenever it can.
Right. And that's what surprised me with it, because I'm like, you know, you get into it and up to this point where you get the shootout, you're like, oh, this feels like a kind of classic John Wayne, you know, black and white 50s type of Western. OK, until we get to the shootout, then they remind you, oh, no, we're right in 76. There's a headshot in here that you're just like, holy crap.
Well, there's also that scene in the beginning. Don't forget when gets into town.
Yeah, and well, but that one, I think, is done a little bit more classic, because you do get a little blood, but not a lot, but he gut shots the guy.
it's like you've murdered me. No, but you're gonna have a long winter. Like, oh my god, he's shot in the stomach.
you're
thinking like Old West, you're thinking like, oh my god, infection.
No, he's not gonna survive the winter. But that gunshot in that scene there is a little bit more classic, you know, kind of, with even with the added a little bit of humor. But this one was like the one where it's just a little more gritty, a little bit, like you said, stripped away kind of the romanticism a little bit of what the John Wayne westerns in the past were. And it's just, it was a little weird seeing that with John Wayne, in the western setting. I think it's a little jaunting, and it makes me wonder what people thought when it first saw, you know, who grew up with John Wayne films were probably like, holy crap. but you do get that second shootout later as he goes out, which I think we'll talk about, because you mentioned about the ripping of the romanticism from the Ron Howard character, because who idolizes Book. And Book sets this going out with dignity up, because you get, as I mentioned before, these three characters who a couple have a beef with him, and one wants to prove himself and thinks he can take him. The Pulfert character who thinks he's the better gunman. And so Wayne sends, and I love this scene, Wayne sends Gillum Rogers, Ron Howard's character, to go tell the message to these three folks that he's going to be at this location at this specific time. And what I loved about this scene, Scott, was Ron Howard's character figuring out what his idol was basically doing, which was setting up his last shootout. How'd you feel about Ron Howard with this one? Because I just loved how that played out, because he's like, wait, I know what you're doing. I mean, how'd you feel about that scene? I thought that was just handled so well, and seeing kind of the first realism for Gilliam, of, oh, this is not what I imagined it to be.
I was going to say, how great is this screenplay?
Mm-hmm.
Because it is a real character piece, and you get everything in that character. I mean, first of all, the Gilliam character with his idealized views on this man, both the legend and who the person he was getting to know, he had to feel a sense of honor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he, like, I'm part of history. I am part of what this man, he entrusted me to do this. This is important. You even get that where the sense, like, where he, John Wayne says, oh, no, it's fine. Go to church first and then do it later. And he can't do it. He can't wait. He can't wait later. I says, no, I got to go. I got to do this. You know, and part of it is the excitement of being in that and the honor of being in that. But also, I mean, how somber do you have to take that? You know,
yeah.
I mean, so he, and when he comes back to John Wayne, to I keep on saying John Wayne because it's a reflection of his, of all of his parts, but it's J.B. Books. He comes back to J.B. Books, and he tells him, you know, what every single person, how every single person reacted, and every person reacted differently.
Yeah.
And he, you know, warns him about the one guy, and he tells him about how the other person was, you know, mm-hmm. looking forward to the honor, and how the other person turned white as a sheet, which I thought was hilarious.
Yeah.
And, you know, you get the, yeah, you get the sense of, like, being real, this character is really conflicted, you know, because he is part of something bigger. He's part of history. He's honored about it. But also, he knows how serious this is. He's kind of learned that in this last week, how serious this is, and what a tremendous thing has been put on his shoulders.
Well, and part of him, because he idolizes and has kind of befriended Books, Gilliam has just a bit of hesitation because he realizes, you know, yeah, I'm part of history, but you get that feeling of hesitation. It's a great moment where he's just like, oh, I know what you're doing.
It was, oh my just goodness. Like, I mean, this person's never been out of the town, probably.
Yeah. You know,
I mean, he's got these great ideas about the world, and now the world has come onto his doorstep, and he's like, yes, I'm asking you to, like, play a part in my death.
Yeah. And you can feel that hesitation a bit from Gil, like, oh, shit. So we get to this final scene, which is directed beautifully because Books has his suit pressed, and he's grown kind of close to Bond, who doesn't really want him to go because she kind of figures out what's going on. That
they have a wonderful goodbye.
They have a wonderful goodbye. I love that scene of when they say goodbye. And she knows exactly when this dusty old cowboy has his Sunday going meet and close pressed by the dry cleaning process. She knows something is seriously up. And you get him, and he just hops on the trolley, and it's kind of taking it leisurely. Meanwhile, the three guys he noticed all have have congregated to this spot, and I just love the tension that's built, and there's nothing really fancy done with it, but it's just the way it was edited and directed. You feel this tension building, and yet you see Books, like, completely, he feels like he's completely content with what he's about to do. He has no reservations, and in fact, he's enjoying the day.
Oh, yeah, I mean, well, it all goes back to the second meeting with Jimmy, the Dr. Hofstadter, Jimmy Stewart's character. And when he does, like, as you were mentioning before, describing how awful it is to die with cancer, And this was, you know, 75 years before the movie came out. You know, it's set in 1901, the dawn of the century. And it had, you know, lots of treatments had come out, you know, chemotherapy and all that other stuff. But it still was, everybody knows somebody who has battled cancer. And I'm pretty sure everybody knows somebody who has lost that battle. Mm-hmm. And it is not a pleasant way to go. Mm-hmm. And he says to this man who is like larger than life to a lot of people, he says, if I had the choice to die that way, I wouldn't.
Right.
And so that's why he sets up this meeting. And he does. He says, and he has a very, you know, I don't think he was planning on that to begin with when he came into town. He said, I'm going to die in this room. Mm-hmm. And I think he decides at that, after that point is when he decides, I'm not going to die in this room.
Right.
I'm going to die on my feet. He goes from that point on, he kind of goes with this very single-minded purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he's completely fine with it. He's completely fine going out this way.
Well, I think he pieced it together after he sees the Sweeney character who he has a history with. That's when he saw, you know, earlier in the film, that's when he saw an opportunity. And then he heard about the Pulford character who said, you know, who would love a chance to you know, go against you. You're right. I don't think he initially went in, even after he got his second diagnosis, he thought maybe that was it, that he was going to die in the bed. And then he heard about, you know, there's this old enemy back and there's this other guy who wants to challenge him. He's like, oh, well, this is how I'm going to do it. And he does it. And it's such an interesting scene because we get the three guys, they're waiting there and they're all staring at each other like, you know, all the bad guys basically of the film, which, you know, they don't really show up till late in the film. They're all looking at each other like, who's going to shoot him first? And then he moseys in. He has himself a whiskey, looks at all of them through the mirror, and his shootout is brutal.
Yeah.
This is the shootist, he goes out with a bang and takes his hits. And he offs two of the guys pretty quickly. I think the two, you know, the Sweeney character and the other guy who was in jail that he pissed off earlier. But then you get the hot shot and he aces him in the head and he's actually shot up, but you could almost think, oh crap, is he not hurt enough to die? I mean that's the thought that came across my head. And then who gives the killing shot, Scott? I thought that was kind of just tragic, so tragic about his character. Here's a guy who's killed so many people face to face, and how does he get killed?
He gets shot in the back by somebody who doesn't know any better, and that was something that he said was going to happen. He actually foretold his death when he's earlier in the film. He's giving Gillum a shooting lesson, and he says it's always some hot shot. You know, it's always somebody who doesn't know what he's doing, and you aren't paying attention who comes up behind you, and that's exactly what happened. It was the bartender of all people who had cleared out, and he comes up behind him with a shotgun.
And shoots him in the back.
Of course, I mean, how would a tragic reality of it is like, of course, I saw this coming. I should have known better. And
it doesn't end there because Gillum comes in and Ron Howard probably has one of the most powerful moments I've seen in his acting. His character comes up, grabs the gun of Books, and he doesn't really hesitate. He just he doesn't even think, does he really?
Most men will take a breath, or they'll blink, they'll hesitate. I won't, just like Books said in the movie. And we find out that he wouldn't either. And there's this very powerful moment where John Wayne, he can't see the man behind him. He can't see his killer. You know, even while he's on the ground dying, he can't see the man who shot him. He only sees this kid who represents the future, basically. represents mm-hmm. somebody who could easily be him. And he realizes this person could easily be him. Because as you say, he does not hesitate. He picks up that gun and bang, 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 shoots this guy and cuts him down. But then comes the most powerful moment.
Where he realizes what he's done, and Gillum actually tosses the gun, and the shootist, in one of his final dying moments, nods his head in approval, like,
yes. Oh,
it's just like, oh my God.
I'm not kidding. If you asked me to like take and say like, oh, Scott, you've seen thousands upon thousands of movies, probably tens of thousands mm-hmm. in my life. Try to rank your favorite movie moments. I don't know if I could, but if I did, this would probably be in the top five.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really one of the most, I mean, it's something that from the moment I saw it, it never left my brain. It was just so incredible because he sees this person who could easily continue this violent legacy of J.B. Books, knowing everything that has to
entail.
Yeah. All the burden of that. I mean, the guy basically dies and he's alone, you know, in life. And he's had to look over his shoulder his whole life. And of course, it doesn't always work out because of how violently he goes. And he sees this thing and he has this moment. And I think that John Wayne was probably had the J.B. Books character probably had a moment of horror when he saw that young hand holding his gun.
Oh, yeah.
And, you then see him toss the gun away, and J.B. Books just closes his eyes and nods, like, thank God.
Yeah.
The cycle is ended.
Well, yeah, and there's a reason why this was set at 1901, because it also gives just the setting of change, because mm-hmm. you hear about Thibodeau talking about how they're going to electrify their trolley within the next year, and they're going to pave the roads and that, so... You have this theme in the background of change too, and how the time of the cowboy in general has kind of passed, and the book's character pretty much embodies all of that, you know, in it, and it just as we mentioned before, real life events later on, it just made it even more poignant in mm-hmm. this film, the fact that it was at kind of a changing of times. And what I loved, and this is where I liked it, and it shows older movie making, and it is a little bit get off my lawn moment, but it's simple fact of the way they end this. Ron Howard Gillum's character leaves the bar, and we pan up and we end credits. We don't do any extra dialogue, we don't do any extra voiceover, we don't have him have some scene where he punches the reporter who suddenly comes up, or you know, tells the reporter, oh, he didn't go out, you know, he killed them all. He just walks over to his, you know, walks away from his mom who comforts him, and they walk away, and it ends there. And I loved how that ended.
Yeah, he just looks straight ahead, you know, basically says, doesn't even have a moment of like, you know, hugging his mom right then and there in the street, just says, no, let's just go.
No, we're done now.
I mean, there's such a whirlpool of emotions going on in the Gillum character at that point. And I guess this ending is far different than the book, which I have not read. I admit I have not read.
Mm-hmm.
Don't even think I've ever had an opportunity to read it. I don't think it's ever come across my path. And, but I mean, there's this, you know, this such a whirlpool of emotions with him. And then, it's over.
Yeah.
It's over. I mean, there's such a difference in change. I mean, let's not forget, you know, John Wayne, he represented a different, he was the last of a dying breed in a lot of respects. I mean, it's funny, you know, like in the mid 60s, he did the only Hollywood movie that was pro Vietnam, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And he directed it. It was called The Green Berets. It's terrible. It's a terrible movie.
It's not a great movie. No, good theme song, but it's got a
It's known as a bad movie. It's a bad one. Sorry, John. But I mean, it was pro Vietnam. You know, mm-hmm. I was trying to get people. You know, no, don't believe these people on TV. You know, who are marching. No, we need to get behind these people. one of his last public appearances before he died. And if you see pictures of it, I've never seen video of it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, if you ever see pictures of it, I mean, you can see how frail he is at that point. Was giving the Best Picture Oscar to The Deer Hunter.
Oh, yeah.
Which some people still say has some enough sentimentality where you could kind of say that it's a little bit pro-Vietnam. It's certainly pro-people, pro-soldier, pro-American.
Right.
But let's be honest. That movie is basically all about how your ideals are disillusioned. You know, that's what the theme is.
Right.
You know, and the idea that that was his last public appearance was giving the Best Picture Oscar to that, which is an amazing film. I'm not bet putting that
right.
On the most.
No, but you're just saying for what he stood for.
It, yeah. And it's talk about a passage of time.
Yeah.
You know.
So I think we're going to wrap it up here. That is The Shootist, folks. Yeah, don't underestimate Westerns. There are a number of them out there especially that actually have a lot to say, had a lot to say, and it's always fun when you see a modern Western and see them try to do it. I mean, recently this past year we had The Magnificent Seven, which was a remake, but I actually enjoyed how it was handled because it felt like kind of the older Westerns. You know, we've had that in the past. They've mostly been remakes, except for we did have Unforgiven. We also had Silverado, which I enjoyed quite a bit. That was an ensemble cast 80s, wasn't it?
Silverado? Yeah, 1985. Don't tell people because they get really spooked out. And when you tell people like explicitly, this is a Western, and they run for the hills, no pun intended. But don't tell me, we've had a few really good Westerns lately. I mean, just in the last couple years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk back to just within the last year, since 2015. What have we had? We've had The Hateful Eight. We've had Bone Tomahawk. We've had Slow West. We've had Jane Got a Gun. We've had The Revenant. We've had Diablo. Ty West's new movie is a Western. Mm-hmm. They're creeping back, and I hope people start to really watch them and really appreciate them before they realize what they're watching, because people freak out. You know, I watch the same thing for musicals too. You know, come on, bring them back. Because, you know, just because you hear something, I don't know what it is about the Western that sends people running, whether they think that it is that. To embrace that is to embrace some old ideas, which might not rightfully be in fashion anymore. That's perhaps it. You know, I mean, let's face it. The idea of, you know, heroic cowboys, a lot of that lies on you know, millions of graves of Native Americans.
Yeah, it is unfortunate that Western is a black
slavery and everything else, you know. But, yes, that is the tragedy, and that is the burden that we're going to have to live with as a people. Mm-hmm. But there is so much in this genre to be respected and held up, and it doesn't mean you have to forget what's awful about it. It means that you have to remember that and always remember what was good about it. And I love these movies. I love Westerns. There was a time, you know, one of my people, when you probably had people ask you, like, what is your favorite movie going experience about going to a theater and your favorite experience at the theater? Me, it's extended one. It lasted for 3 months.
Wow.
Because one summer, and I was already a huge fan. One summer when I was in college and I was still living on campus, though I wasn't taking any classes, I don't think. The Oak Street Cinema in St. Paul, Minnesota, which is no longer there. The Oak Street, St. Paul's still there.
At least today it is.
Yeah, today, like, fingers crossed. Like, but they had a summer-long John Wayne Film Festival. I was there two or three times a week, every time they changed the movie. And sometimes I saw double features. Sometimes I just saw single ones. But I'd say I saw probably about 30 of John Wayne's movies on the big screen.
Nice.
Including this one. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, if you really delve into this, there's a lot to respect about this man. You don't have to love his politics, but God damn it, you have to love the sense of honor that mm-hmm. he represented, and the range of the acting range that he brought to each role.
Well, and, except for maybe The Conqueror.
Well, as I said, you know, when we talk, as I said, I was meant to mention this earlier. When we talk about range, we don't talk about accents, and the worst, like the go-to for the worst casting in history is John Wayne as Genghis Khan.
I'm sorry,
and as if that wasn't bad enough, the movie probably killed him. You know, because so many of that cast and crew got cancer from that set. You know, that probably had a hand in killing him.
Yeah, I've heard stories like that, that they suspect that that's possibly where he got ill, was from this set. Yeah.
Well, I mean, he was allegedly cancer-free when he was doing the shootist, but it's pretty obvious that he was ill.
He wasn't feeling well. You can tell that it just...
That probably something had emerged and they just weren't aware of it.
Some of it was acting, and some of it he didn't need to act as much.
Yeah. But he was an amazing actor, and you know, I would really, especially our younger listeners, you know, assuming we have them, I would really urge them to, with an open mind, seek out the old Westerns, seek out the films of John Wayne and the other people who were stars of the era, the great films of John Ford, Howard Hawks, and really look into them. You're going to see something that is amazing. And if you shut yourself off to this, you are shutting yourself off to some of the greatest cinematic art that you will ever witness.
Well said. Yeah, there's cinematography alone. Cinematography students out there should look at Westerns and see how they shot, you know, landscapes and everything. It's really impressive, especially back then for the size of cameras and everything that they had. So Westerns are, I think, a genre that I think deserve a little bit more attention, and it does seem like they're getting more of it now, which is nice, because yeah, as much as it is a black mark in our history, there is a lot of stories to be told and stories there that, you know, it's definitely an era that welcomes stories, that almost encourages it in many ways with the characters and such that there were back then. So I think we'll wrap it up here, Scott, since it is just you and I. Why don't you tell folks just here where they can find your stuff at?
Oh, moseying out onto the pasture.
Heading into the sunset.
Into the sunset. No, it's God willing, no. I haven't really done much with my website lately, but I'm working to really get it going again, hopefully in the new year. And until then, you can catch all the old stuff at moviocrity.com. And you can catch my web series, Moviocrity, on Vimeo and on YouTube.
Awesome. And I thank you, Scott, for joining me and talking about this Western.
Thank you.
You know, and like I said, it was one when I revisited it, I forgot how good it was. And it's just a good film. Even if you're not really partial to Westerns, just as far as films go, especially from 76, this, I think, is one of the better ones that came out during that time. And I hope you enjoyed our series of covering films that have been 40 years old. Hopefully it wet your whistle. We've had some odd ones, from horror films to dramas to comedies to B-movies and Westerns and everything in between. So hope you enjoyed this series. Just look back on our webpage at specialmarkproductions.com for the Spoiler Room podcast archive. And you can see all the ones labeled for 40th. The big 4-0 specials, and those are all the ones we did that are films from 76, or check out any of the other episodes we have there. Also on Stitcher Radio and iTunes, please subscribe and comment. That always helps us out. We appreciate every single one of you, and as we say, have a good evening, everyone, as we head out into the sunset. And yeah, any words to add, Scott?
No. I was going to come up with something really clever. God damn it, I couldn't think of one.
It's getting late. And our
it's getting really late, but I do want to say thank you so much, Mark, for doing this series, because not only was it great to revisit these films from 1976, but I think it's great to have it out there that there were so many great movies made in that era, that and including a lot that I think people may have overlooked. So this is a wonderful series, so thank you.
You bet. And it's been a lot of fun to revisit some of these. And yeah, 76 was an interesting year. We will have another special series. Look for our webpage in that soon. Subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher Radio, and you can follow along with all the episodes. Next week, we will be doing our best of worst of 2016. Haven't done one of those in a while. And then after that, we may talk about a specific sci-fi film that came out recently. So stay tuned here, all my fellow listeners out there. Thank you so much for joining us, and say goodnight, Scott.
Goodnight, Scott.
Goodnight, Scott.